This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I like the poem from Camus, you know, time in the open air, love for another being, freedom from ambition, creation. You know, so it's not saying that we shouldn't be ambitious, it's saying just have freedom from that ambition.
As we approach Labor Day, now seems like a good time to think not only about the value of our labor, but about the value of the time we spend not working. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is William Powers, author of New Slow City, a reflection of an unhurried, minimalist life in the heart of high-speed Manhattan. In his book, Powers offers an alternative philosophy for living, one that stands in stark contrast to the American ethos of constant growth and unending expansion of production and consumption. We have a conversation about the root of our obsession with work, the drawbacks of constantly striving for increased productivity, the influence of technology on the quality of time, and how better stewardship of the planet may be tied to just slowing down. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by William Powers. His latest book is New Slow City. Bill, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much, Alex.
So your last book before New Slow City was 12 by 12, and you've written several others. You're coming to us live right now from Bolivia. Tell us a little bit about your journey from New York City to Bolivia and how New Slow City fits in that narrative.
Well, that's right. I'm talking to you now looking at a window at the San Juan Mountains, Ambaro National Park, which is more biodiverse than all of Costa Rica put together. It's an incredibly rich area where the Amazon meets the Andes, just a gorgeous day here. And the journey from Greenwich Village to this small village in Bolivia is sort of part of the story of New Slow City, the new book. We basically spent a year trying to live the slow ethic in the world's fastest city in New York. And, you know, my wife and I moved from a 1,800 square foot townhouse in Queens to about a 350 square foot micro apartment in Manhattan, and really minimalized. You know, we eliminated 80% of our stuff and began to not only live more simply, but also with more time richness or leisure. I started out working a two-day work week, which was slightly countercultural in Manhattan, as you can imagine. And that eventually went up to a sweet spot of about 4 days a week, where I found my highest productivity without overworking. And so, you know, the book sort of talks about that whole experience and also how, you know, as much as we learned to live slow in an urban environment, how wonderful it was, at the end it was time to, you know, follow our dream of re-villaging in Bolivia, joining the transition town movement and so forth. So we're part of a really wonderful community of people from 33 countries here in this town, working on stuff like alternative energy, organic agriculture, work parties, community gardening, municipal ordinances around all the positive things that are part of this change that we're seeing globally.
And this is part of your work also with the World Policy Institute, correct?
Yes, I'm at the World Policy Institute, where I've been for 7 years, and we have a project called Vivir Bien, or Living Well, which is based here in Samaipata and in New York City at the Institute. And basically what we're doing is we're looking at Bolivia's Law of Mother Earth, its Living Well policies nationally, which are trying to look at, you know, ways of living more in harmony, not only with nature, but also with ourselves and finding more happiness. And how do you do that, you know? So we're scaling up and megaphoning through the World Policy Journal some of these ideas about living well.
So what you mentioned in the book is also a Japanese phenomenon, or the Japanese have a word for it, karoshi, which means dying from overworking. You don't have to be a Japanese salaryman to have this type of reality. There are people in first world, developing world countries all over who are literally killing themselves for work. A lot of critics would say that, well, you're an educated first worlder, so you have the luxury to be able to downsize. But you're actually walking the walk, it seems like.
Well, yeah, that's true that a lot of people think that. But, you know, the average subsistence hunter-gatherer lifestyle is about 22 hours a week, according to all these anthropological studies. You know, just to be able to gather what you need and support yourself physically and provide your shelter, that's about what it takes, especially in more tropical areas. So it's really more the Western disease of overwork that's being exported through urbanization, globalization to developing countries. You know, when I look out the window here in Bolivia, there's more of a leisure ethic than a work ethic, which I've seen in some 50, 60 countries where I've written and traveled and worked.
And many look down at that in the United States.
Absolutely.
But, and right. What's wrong with that perspective of thinking that you're not really worth your salt if you're not working 40 to 70 hours a week?
Well, that's what I call the busy trap, you know, which is where it's just so cool to be busy. You know, what are you doing? Oh, I'm just so busy, you know. And it has to do with our colonization into an industrial model of seeing ourselves as part of this big machine of the economy and losing our identity as creatures, you know, like other creatures, other animals, where animals are free and they don't have that kind of a tight schedule. So we're so conditioned into thinking that our self-image and self-worth is based upon being busy and working that we don't feel fully human without that. So in some ways, there's this rich exchange between developing countries, so-called developing countries. Again, that's a term that's based upon our idea of progress. But, and most of the terms around development have been similarly created by the West. But there's a real rich dialogue in terms of, you know, how we can work 24/7. And I don't mean all the time, but I mean, you know, 24 hours a week, 7 months a year. You know, how do we get back into a rhythm where technology is our tool and we're not its fool? You know, that we're able to be more and not always have more. So these are the kind of things that, you know, we're trying to just recover here in Bolivia. You know, for example, there's a siesta right now. In fact, it's lunchtime here and nobody's working right now. There's this long lunch with the family, siesta culture, which still has not been taken away. Although, as you know, in a lot of developing countries, that siesta culture is disappearing because they're requiring short lunches. Even in La Paz here in Bolivia, in the capital, they've eliminated the siesta in all government jobs and in corporate jobs.
Is this trying to instill more of a American kind of ethos into government and worker productivity, or is there something else at play there?
Absolutely. It's the globalization phenomenon where to be competitive globally, you know, Bolivian firms and even the government has to be working the old 24/7, which is all the time. And it's unfortunate.
As my hands grow busy, as the lines on my face tend not to notice what the young girls embrace. Will it be silly or will it be wise? Tend not to notice through these old weary eyes. The grown one is the slow one. It's never too early and often too late. Tend not to notice what we don't elevate. Will it be?
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to William Powers. His latest book is New Slow City. So let's talk about your experience in Manhattan, trying to capture that same feeling of oneness and peacefulness without feeling like a deadbeat. How can you find that balance in a rat race city like New York?
Well, you know, a lot of it's just the perspective that you have on life. The problem isn't necessarily Manhattan or Los Angeles or Tokyo or whatever big city you live in. It's the lens through which you're looking at it. So if you just kind of like take the lint off the lens or just change the lens, everything's different. So we started approaching it more through a philosophy of just enjoying life, first of all, and not being competitive all the time and trying to get ahead and trying to stay on top of every email. So some of the practical tools we used were, you know, technology fasts where we go for 4 or 5 days, my wife and I, just offline completely and just having romantic dinners and hikes and walks in Central Park and so on. Another that anyone can do is, you know, urban sanctuaries, like whether it's some kind of a church or temple in your city or a nice part of a park that you love, some body of water, whether it's a bay or an ocean or riverside, whatever, any of these types of spaces or even the rooftop. We love, you know, the rooftop of our building in Greenwich Village was an incredible urban sanctuary. These are places where you can just sort of be and enjoy and watch whatever natural phenomena are happening around you, the breeze, the scents of different flowers or whatever it is, and so on. And then you go back refreshed and more productive into whatever you're doing in the city.
And it can actually be more empowering or more revitalizing sometimes when it's right there in the city. I lived in Tokyo for 3 years and Kyoto for 1 year. And these are very densely populated areas. But there's these Buddhist temples and other lovely little places where you'd go and find people just doing more what we would consider mundane duties and just sweeping and being at one with their little nook in this otherwise very crazy little world. And when you reemerge from that little sanctuary, like you're saying, you feel almost more refreshed. Maybe that contrast is what can revitalize the spirit.
Absolutely. Yeah, the contrast, the texture. You know, the founder of Slow Food said, you know, always going slow is stupid. What we're looking for is a self-paced life. And the tempo gusto, which is the right pace. And that includes adjusting fast and slow as you want. So there's a beautiful aspect. I found it incredibly relaxing in Manhattan to be switching from, you know, getting into the groove of the craziness and the crack of connectedness and so on to these beautiful sanctuaries that are all around you.
And this productivity that we always are striving for on a policy level, it seems. How is that antithetical to a manageable sustainability effort?
Well, there's two things. On a personal level, you can actually be more productive through less work. You know, if you 80-20 your life, which is where you look at the 80% of your activities that are only achieving 20% of the results, and then conversely, 20% of what you're doing is achieving 80% of the results. And if you look at your work activities, you'll find that this is almost inevitably true. And then you start to work in that area of the 20%. And you can do it through the Hodgkinson's principle, which is that, you know, work expands to fill the amount of time that you have by then setting yourself short deadlines in that 20%. So you're just being much more effective in shorter periods of time. And that's sort of how I was able to scale back my hours. But secondly, on a more societal level, which I think you're also asking about, well, yeah, we need productivity because we're in a growth model where you have to show quarterly profits of all the corporations in order to, you know, continue to deliver shareholder value and so on. So you have to have this constant economic growth. That's what's killing the siesta in Bolivia and causing ecocide or destruction of the Earth's living systems by the economic model. So there's this crazy model of growth, which is the logic of the cancer cell, by the way, in a finite biosphere. So yes, we need to reform this system. But I like, you know, the ideas of Charles Eisenstein, where he's sort of saying in Sacred Economics, his book, that it doesn't have to be this abrupt change or this top-down kind of economic change at the global level, that, you know, we can have it be a slow process and an incremental process where at a local level, we're doing things like this transition town movement where we're valorizing the local economies, where we're finding what Juliet Shore, the economist, calls self-provisioning activities, where we're, you know, creating our own streams of income and growing our own food and so forth. And we're living into this transition to an economy that's not just growth-based.
And do you think this movement, the slow movement, do you think that this has to come from individual level, or do you think that there can be some concomitant policies from corporations and governments to try to, for lack of a better word, accelerate this slowing down?
Well, we absolutely need to have policy-based changes. For example, Bhutan's ideas of gross national happiness have come to places like Seattle and Portland and Vancouver, Vermont, Maryland, and elsewhere, where the state governments are actually, and local governments are looking at how to build the economy or the economic indicators around things like having more time to spend with friends and family and so on, which is really what people want, not just a pure number growth. So that's one, is how we measure it. And there's lots of wonderful stuff being done with the Genuine Progress Indicator. Also groups like, you know, the Center for a New American Dream in DC and the Capital Institute in New York that are working on this policy level. And that's a big, big part of the picture. But honestly, it's not just going to happen that way, because we also have to have a massive change in our consciousness level. And I don't think any of the top-down policies are going to happen without people like your listeners, like you and myself, really looking at our lives and saying, what's important? You know, what's ultimately important? And when we start to touch that more sensual, physical, lovely reality that comes from the more simpler things in life, you know, time with your friends and family, gardening, just general leisure time, hobbies and activities that we love to do and don't have to do for money, you know, sort of taking the marketplace out of our lives more, we start to wake up to the fact that we don't need to be wage slaves on the work and spend treadmill. We're always trying to go from paycheck to paycheck, but we just slowly start to evolve into people who are more free of the system. And then, of course, once that happens, those types of citizens that we're seeing this through so many movements that you know of, the transition movement, the slow movements, you know, slow travel, slow food, slow money, all these, in addition to, you know, farmers markets and all the local, locavore and local activities that you're seeing, all of that's part of this bigger change. And it's going to affect the policy level.
Had we lived, I'd tell it true. Nothing is ever too late. Plow the sea and work the wind. Learn to labor and to wait. So we go.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author William Powers. His latest book is New Slow City. And let's talk about on a company level. For example, have you been following the Amazon press that came out earlier in August in the New York Times? There was a piece examining the productivity of workers and their happiness, basically, at Amazon.
Right. Yes, of course I've been following that. And that's just another example of this, almost like a disease.
One of the quotes that popped out at me was, I think it was Jeff Bezos, and I could be wrong, but it sounded logical, but he said, it's more productive to have 10 people working on a project for 70 hours a week than 20 people working on a project for 35 hours a week. Makes sense, probably, from a, if you are a shareholder of Amazon, you would want that. But if you are an employee at Amazon, why would you not want that?
Right, exactly. That's why I kind of agree with billionaire Carlos Slim's call for a 3-day work week. You know, he just said that he realized that that's the sweet spot, 3 11-hour days. And that's what other social scientists have said, is that, you know, after about 35 hours, you're getting decreasing returns to scale in terms of each additional hour is marginally less productive. So I would disagree with that. I mean, of course, there's transaction costs with having those additional employees.
I think so much of this also is inculcated at a very young age in people's career arc when they start getting out of college and they look in, they read the profiles of these successful people. I remember reading Fortune magazine on a plane of some CEO, I can't remember who he was, very successful. Maybe it was like Jack Welch of GE. And it seemed like it was a pattern, though. It was all these profiles of these CEOs who were like, Jack Welch ran 6 miles before 5 a.m. And he was already like, had gone through all of his press clippings by 6 a.m. And he sleeps 3 or 4 hours a day. It's the same thing with these successful NFL coaches. They sleep on their couch and we glorify that. These people are obviously workaholics and they have serious problems. And yet that's the message that you're getting at a young age, is like, that's what it takes to succeed. But there's a cost attached to that success, isn't there?
There is. There's three levels of costs to that. One is our health. You know, the incredible levels of stress that are associated with this number one sort of first world disease, not just the Kiroshis in Japan committing suicide over overwork, but just the way that it affects everyone, all the Prozac and all the other sort of pharmaceuticals and therapy and everything else that comes out of overworking. Secondly is just relationships and time with family and time with friends, like the quality of relationships, like divorce rate being so high and everything else, is kind of a direct product of not having the time to just feed quality in your relationships.
Do you think that maybe part of the narrative that's being crafted is because most of the people who have the power to craft policy and the messaging are some of these people who don't take enough time off? And so they want to kind of, their way must be the right way because they're holding the keys to the kingdom, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. That's there's absolutely why that narrative is the dominant narrative.
And what can we do to break it?
First of all, you can just sort of right now, whatever you're doing, just stop for a second and take a deep breath, look out the window, like just notice what's around you. Yeah, you know, I just think that there's the so-called spiritual perspectives on things, you know, meditation, yoga, all of these practices of just coming more into the present moment and being less in your mind and more in your body is part of it. Because our minds have been conditioned through 500,000 commercials by the time we were 12 years old and all the other type of peer-to-peer conditioning and so on in this system. And by the way, the system that we're looking at is ultimately completely unsustainable environmentally. It's causing climate change, deforestation, you know, massive destruction of coral reefs and oceans, all the environmental problems we know about. And a genuine unhappiness. Now, sure, some of these CEOs you're talking about, they're the winners, but they're 0.01% of society. And sure, that kind of an ethos of overwork has taken them to that place. But it's also caused incredible inequality and stress in society and left so many losers out of it. And the societal cost is enormous of this type of hyper-competitive system. And there's this culturally created dogma or narrative that that's how people are. That's how human beings are. We're competitive Homo sapiens, that, you know, survival of the fittest and so on. There's incredible amount of scientific evidence against that, that actually we're by nature cooperative. If you look at forests, they're not, it's not that the trees are competing against each other. There's a synergy. We're actually underground in the root systems. They're actually helping each other grow. And there's all kinds of evidence for, you know, cooperation, even in our closest relative, the bonobos, which we're only like 2% genetically different from, have a totally pacific, cooperative society where they've never killed. There's never been any evidence of one bonobo killing another. It's just really, and again, Charles Eisenstein talks about this in great eloquence in his book about how we really are cooperative, and we need to take that back, that ethos.
You mentioned how you and your wife will go several days disconnected from technology. How has technology in your research for this book changed the way people are productive and the way that they value happiness? Has it been transformed by our seeming addiction to these devices?
Right. People spend an average of 13 and a half hours a day on gadgets now. And, you know, most of that's checking work email, in some ways working. And 75% of Americans actually check their smartphones under the table at dinner, you know, and something like 80%, the person.
I would never do such a thing.
You'd never do.
Never.
Or, you know, 80% of people who are in the morning, the first thing they do when they wake up is check the phone, right? But the cost of that is your own creativity, because really the place where you find creativity is in your own thoughts and in nature, and just not responding to everyone else's little immediacy of what they need from you. And there's been a huge cost. That's why I say, like, you know, making technology your tool and not you its fool. That just means using it smartly. And that's sort of what Technology Fast were all about. It was about using that wonderful vacation auto response on email. And I'm out of the office for the next 5 days. Please leave a message or contact whoever, colleague, in the meantime. And then nurture kind of creativity sabbaticals, where you're thinking of new income streams you want to create, or if you're an artist or a writer, projects like that, and so on. You know, so yeah, it's having more of a balanced relationship with technology. And then the other thing is that, you know, weren't these devices supposed to be time-saving devices? Wasn't they the original purpose, right?
Exactly.
You know, and actually they've created more of a time suck. But, you know, but what I find is just that, like, through this whole writing this book and meeting all these cultural creatives on the edge of slow and so on, like, if you are using these devices smartly, my gosh, it is so productive. I mean, you have everything at your fingertips. If you know, if you have your north, your personal north, and know what you need to do and so on, and you just engage technology towards that, it's wow. It's very powerful.
Well, it's an excellent message to have as we approach the Labor Day weekend for people to learn to labor, but also to wait.
Right. That's a good point about waiting. And, you know, having this, I like the poem from Camus, you know, time in the open air, love for another being, freedom from ambition, creation. You know, so it's not saying that we shouldn't be ambitious. It's saying just have freedom from that ambition and mostly focus on creation, or doing what you feel most passionate about and what you know is the correct thing, not what you're kind of forced to do in what basically amounts to a kind of a wage slavery situation. And reclaiming, you know, our freedom and our right as humans to organize locally and to be part of communities, and not just homo economicus, or, you know, productive sort of beings in a larger economy.
Well, it's a fascinating tale. His personal journey, New Slow City, William Powers. Bill, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks a lot, Alex. I appreciate it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Miles Davis and Alex Wise.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.